This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Directly address the kind of gaps between how Americans in our own news media and public discussion address grief of Americans and how the grief of other people is dealt with. And essentially, after working on a lot of issues of war and peace for really a few decades, I've been more and more struck by a sort of an emotional apartheid that affects our public discussion and our politics. That grief is really profound when it affects the Americans who are focused on, and that it's incidental if it's other people, particularly those who are made in a mournful situation by U.S. military action. And so that tremendous gap seems almost to be the emperor's new clothes, that it isn't really mentioned directly. It's sometimes mentioned obliquely, sometimes when there's a tragedy like the bombing at the Boston Marathon, then there'll be a commentary from someone in the progressive arena saying, well, gee, how come we care about those kids, but we don't seem as a society or mass media to be caring much about kids who are bombed by U.S.-led NATO forces in Afghanistan, for example. And I think those are important points to make. They're not often made frontally about this overall phenomenon of what I call in the article our twisted politics of grief.
And has this, do you think, always been the case? Is there some event in our history that has made this more twisted than it perhaps used to be? Or are we always more caring about those more closely related to us?
To some extent, I think it's always been part of the social human condition, unfortunately, which isn't to justify it and isn't to say that it should be accepted. It should certainly be challenged. But that sort of gap has been magnified, I believe, by the spin of mass media, the extreme technology that's brought to bear on the killing machinery that is at its highest level, if you want to call it that. At the Pentagon, the U.S. has the most well-developed, again, if you want to call it that, means of technological killing of any other entity on the planet. And I think that magnifies almost exponentially, but certainly boosts the gap there. It's so extreme. And the global media capacities, whether cable television or social media or whatever, it's in people's face, including people who live in societies where life is devalued by U.S. actions and attitudes. And although I had written this piece largely before President Obama's major address on the U.S. war effort on Thursday last week, there was a way in which his speech, I think, dovetailed with this phenomenon, because he only very briefly in one sentence and in an understated way referred to the pain of loved ones who lost their loved ones from U.S., say, drone strikes. But it was immediately set aside and reframed by Obama talking about how difficult it has been that he and others in his chain of command, as he put it, would be haunted by those deaths for the rest of their lives. And so even when there's discussion of the suffering of people who have been bombed by the U.S. military, including civilians, that human reality is immediately put in the context of American agony and American standing in the world and policy dilemmas faced by officials in Washington.
And do you think that's an intentional technique that he is using so as not to call too much attention to the actual grief that is occurring elsewhere?
Well, certainly the scripted speech is very intentionally worded to tiptoe around the forbidden areas, the no-go zones, which would include really talking directly about the grief of civilians in Yemen or Pakistan or Afghanistan who, due to premeditated U.S. policy, have been injured, been killed, leaving behind those who are mourning. And that's very much a choice because, although it's rarely explicitly said in a very gauche, overt, crude way, a lot of the assumption of U.S. politician discourse about American foreign policy and military action is that American lives matter profoundly, and the lives of people at the other end of U.S. weaponry, their lives hardly matter at all. And it's considered almost improper to even say what is being said in a direct way, and so there's all sort of eliding and avoiding and euphemisms to get around the fact that it's almost sociopathic, that U.S. foreign policy is based on a sociopathic ethos, if that's not an oxymoron, that we can't really concern ourselves very much about the pain or suffering that we inflict as a country through the U.S. so-called Defense Department and the military. And for those reasons, this kind of detour becomes very corrosive, and it's intellectually dishonest, it's Orwellian, it is cognitive dissonance for our preferred sense of ourselves as people who are consistently humanitarian and care about all human beings. And so when it comes down to a major or minor speech like the one Obama recently gave at the National Defense University, it's very carefully crafted to not shatter the construct that is so Orwellian and so basic to U.S. foreign policy.
Does the whole aspect of Obama being a good speechmaker, I mean, he is able to move people with his words, how does that play into this whole thing and what you're observing around grief?
It makes the dynamic even slicker. And when the contradictions are so extreme, then a crude, a fairly inarticulate president making a speech is likely to get more of a pushback, even if it's not a very well-focused one, a discomfort, a sense of critique from progressives. But when somebody who is so good at conveying a sense of nuance, a sense of even inner conflict, as Obama did in his speech, then the empathy shift often is subtle but quite effective, that it's the perpetrators of the killing who deserve so much empathy. The moral anguish is pumped up by how articulate the president is, the moral anguish of those who have ordered the killing. And so the focus then becomes similar to what we sometimes hear about the Israeli government vis-a-vis Palestinians, that Israeli leaders are just in such moral anguish. That may or may not be true, and you know, who's to judge the internal condition, but the notion that whether it's the president of the United States or the president of Russia or any other country that orders such killing, that we should quickly revert to or focus on their anguish and sort of set aside the pedestrian sorrow and mourning and grief of those who they have ordered to be killed and their loved ones, that's a very smooth oratorical impact. And I think that, you know, for whatever else we might say about Obama, he's very adept at evoking identification with him and his quandary, And often those who are suffering from his policies are put way, way in the background.
I'm speaking with Norman Solomon on Political Perspectives. We're talking about Norman's article called Our Twisted Politics of Grief, published on Monday in Common Dreams, and it is available on his site, normansolomon.com. Can you talk about drones and how they relate to this polarization or politicization of grief?
Well, they're very impressive, you know, from a technical standpoint. The high-tech capacity of drones to do what they do, I think that all really assists the longstanding U.S. Military and political capacity to offload moral responsibility from the public agenda. I mean, you know, Kathleen, I'm thinking of when KABU Studios were back on Belmont Street in Southeast Portland, the Vietnam War was still going. It was the early 1970s. I remember interviewing an editor from the Oregonian at that time. It must have been 1972. And that editor was defending the ongoing horrific U.S. air war in Vietnam. And recalling that now, you know, several decades later, just underscores to me how longstanding this has been, that at that point it was B-52 bombers. That technology was dazzling and impressive and embraced by so many forces who either were enthusiastic about the war on Vietnam or accepting of it. And today, drone technology, I think, is very attractive to many. As a matter of fact, I cite in my article the latest national poll from New York Times CBS from a few weeks ago shows that 70% of Americans favor, they say, the use of drones to kill foreign targets and people around the world, and that's compared to 20% who said they were opposed. So a 7-to-2 ratio in favor. And whether it's drones or cruise missiles or other technical and on-the-ground means to smite the purported evildoers, the technology makes it easier. And the idea that we somehow are more civilized about our killing, whereas those crude, unsophisticated, violent people put a suicide belt on or drive a car laden with explosives, that they do it in such an inhuman way and we do it humanly, that's a delusion that is grabbing hold of the U.S. technological prowess and telling ourselves a story which is just so fundamentally false and craven and depraved that because we can kill people with drones and other high technology entities, that somehow that makes us moral in doing it. And it's a real challenge for us to sort of wake up out of that mesmerizing slumber and confront what George Wald, the Nobel-winning biologist, said in a speech in 1969. He said, and I'm quoting here, the U.S. government is in the business of killing. And that was true in 1969, and it's true in 2013.
So if we look back to Vietnam, there is that same, it's not exactly demonization of the enemy, but a devaluing of the whole humanity of the so-called enemy in all these situations, and that seems to be a constant. And then what you're saying, adding to that, is the removal, the ability to remove the actual physical killing, the actual aspects of the physical killing more and more and more from the process.
Yes, the devaluing, I think, is aided by an abstraction about the entire process, that it somehow becomes an activity of not only chain of command, but a technological achievement. And it's part of a numbing process. It certainly can be an accentuation of the numbing process. And then if the people being killed are not considered to be really people at all, the machinery is running away with the whole process and humanity becomes very much secondary, if present at all.
Now, in your article, you also write about the issue of terror and what it is seen to mean for Americans and what it means for others. Can you talk about that?
Yes, terror is really the keynote word of the purported justification for what the last 12 years has been called the war on terror and the ongoing U.S. war effort in several countries. The idea that our own government is terrorizing people is just antithetical to the entire media and mass political frame in this country. But it's incontrovertibly true. I quote David Rohde, the former, but at that time, New York Times reporter who was held captive in the tribal areas, the rugged terrain of Pakistan. And he has written vividly about how terrifying it is to hear the sound of drones overhead and to know that at any moment those hellfire missiles can make you dead. And one of the standards is to just switch and see what it would be like if the shoe were on the other foot. What if I was on a farm in Willamette Valley, or I was in downtown Portland, for that matter, and I heard the sound of a drone overhead, knowing, because it had happened before in the region, that at any moment that drone could fire a missile and kill someone, not always anybody but a civilian who just happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, just to imagine how terrifying that would be to hear that sound overhead. And the failure, the unwillingness, the hostility of U.S. mass media or most any elected officials to acknowledge that is really, I think, a giveaway. And for whatever virtues he may have, President Obama is fundamentally part of that problem, because it's not only he won't mention it, he keeps putting the halo over himself and U.S. forces as the antithesis of terror, when actually we are part of this process that, as W.H. Auden said in his poem 1939, those to whom evil is done do evil in return. So here we are, you know, the middle of 2013, and it's a tremendous challenge to push even some of the best members of the U.S. Congress, like, say, Senator Merkley, to go beyond the easy political nostrums and to say, look, the U.S. War that is ongoing is a fundamental driver of terrorism and violence in the world, and until we can end that war effort, not just as Obama said, you know, ultimately, was his word, ultimately end it, while his administration has said it's expected to go for another 10 to 20 years, but to end that war effort now is really an imperative, or this cycle of violence globally will continue to be boosted by the strongest military entity in the world, and of course that's the Pentagon.
Yeah, I guess I was going to ask, what are the long-term consequences of, as you say, the refusal of the administration to come to terms with the grief and rage it's caused with its military actions?
A lot of the consequences, I think, involve continued downward spirals where we are anesthetized more and more. The ongoing perpetual war is increasingly normalized with so many different consequences. The looting of the public sphere, healthcare, education, housing, public transportation, being depleted of resources while this war machinery keeps going on, and the normalization of government attacks on civil liberties, such as we've seen with this administration going after so many whistleblowers, unprecedented volume of prosecutions of whistleblowers, going after Associated Press and Fox News and so forth, surveillance of just, again, an unprecedented scale of the press, of news media in this country. And that is all the more reason, I think, that if we understand the civil liberties of our country to be precious, then a war that is based on two tiers of grief, the tier that is profoundly important and precious, and the tier that is inconsequential. Until we can end a two-tier view of the world, until we can embrace and accept that human grief is of great human importance and consequence universally, then the war machinery keeps being cranked up, and all these untoward consequences will continue to deepen.
Do you think it's almost like people have to dehumanize in order to continue these policies?
I think that's an important part of the dynamic, that looking directly at and feeling the humanity of those whose lives are being so terribly harmed by U.S. policies, that would create such tremendous cognitive dissonance in terms of our self-image of who we are, who we tell ourselves we are. It would, with urgency, call us forward to say, no, this just status quo is not acceptable, and we're not willing to go along with tweaking and slowly changing the operation of this war machinery. That would be very painful. It would call into question, you know, who we are, and in political terms, it would require that we put on the heat of our elected officials, the Blumenauers, the Wydens, the others who make nice noises, but when push comes to shove, they continue to basically suck up to the White House. This should be unacceptable, but it's acceptable because we are numbed to the what Martin Luther King Jr. called the madness of militarism, and it's certainly very much operative and in many respects dominant today.
I'm speaking with Norman Solomon about his recent article, Our Twisted Politics of Grief. In this last couple minutes of the interview, Norman, is there anything you wanted to say that we haven't said or anything you feel like we should emphasize?
Well, I think that independent communication is so important because the major media outlets that have the largest reach in this country, it's almost a truism that the wider the reach, the less valuable the message and the less important the information that's being shared. And so I do believe that as we organize, and we've got to organize politically, both in terms of public protest and in terms of electoral activity, it's also crucial to support independent media outlets. And certainly people are listening to one of those crucial independent outlets, KABU. If we can continue to build strength in our ability to communicate with and learn from each other every day through independent media, then we have a better chance to turn around these very negative dynamics in our country.
Well, thank you for that, Norman, and thank you for your early work here at KABU in the early 70s at KABU Radio. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And I want to let people know that I have been speaking with Norman Solomon. He is the author of numerous books. His recent article published in Common Dreams is Our Twisted Politics of Grief, and you can access it now by going to Norman's site, which is normansolomon.com. Norman, again, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks to you and to KABU for all the wonderful work.
Okay. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
I need somebody, help, not just anybody, help, you know I need someone, help.
The Breakfast with the Boo 45th birthday event is shaping up to be a well-attended morning, where we plan to feed pancakes and fruits, nuts, and flakes to more than 1,000 people. KABU needs to borrow pancake griddles, waffle irons, large coffee makers, and coffee and tea carafes to ensure quick service for the hungry masses. We also need help with food donations and people to flip pancakes, seat guests, bus tables, and decorate the auditorium. If you can help with any of this, please contact Lynn Fitch, manager at kboo.org, or leave a message, 503-231-8032, extension 222.
somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone.
Coming up next, we hear an excerpt from the X Series Economic Update with host Richard Wolf. He interviews independent journalist and writer Laura Flanders of Grit TV.
It gives me great pleasure now to turn to my guest. She is Laura Flanders. She is very famous. I am very lucky to have her with me. I've known her for quite some time. I want to tell you a little bit about her, and bear with me because there's a lot to tell. Laura is most famous, I think, for the whole institution known as Grit TV. She founded it, she organized it, she ran it for many years, she still works with it. It is an independent producer of all kinds of programming that has appeared across the country on various television stations. She's a regular writer for The Nation magazine. Her work has appeared in These Times, The Progressive, Ms. Magazine. She has appeared on television programs more than I can count, but I'm going to just quickly list a few of them. The Lou Dobbs Tonight Show, The O'Reilly Factor, Hannity and Combs, enough said. Washington Journal, Donahue, Good Morning America, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, The Ed Show, Real Time with Bill Maher. It is an extraordinary pleasure for me to welcome Laura as one of the premier independent and critical journalists working in the United States today. She's also the accomplished author of several books, but in order to give you a chance to hear her, I won't do the list. Laura, thank you very much for coming.
It's great to be with you, Rick.
I understand you've just come back from some work about a group of miners with a wonderful historical story in Virginia.
Yes,
tell us about it.
Well, I just posted a story at grittv.org that people can find, or at thenation.com, about the brewing fight in the coal fields that isn't actually taking place in the coal fields. It's taking place outside a federal courthouse in St. Louis. Get that. It sort of speaks volumes about everything that you talk about on this program, about how our world has changed for labor. 24 years ago, there was a struggle in the coal fields that really was at the pit head gates of the Pittston Coal Company in Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky. Miners were being threatened with losing their retirement benefits, the guaranteed quality health care that the United Mine Workers of America has won for the guys who work underground and the few women over the many, many years of struggle of the last century. Pittston, the coal company, was trying to offload those retiree benefits. The people, miners, their families, church leaders, communities showed up in the thousands, as did the press, to fight back that attack.
Effectively escape, making good on all those years of donations of the workers' money into that pension fund.
23,000 miners and their families stand to lose their retirement benefits, and some other 1,700 active working miners stand to lose on the job benefits and working conditions. It's a huge struggle. Where's the media? They're barely blinking. And it speaks a lot about how what I call the kind of extreme capitalism of our era has come, that they are now targeting really a bastion of 20th century labor organizing, the United Mine Workers. If the United Mine Workers and what have been built over the years as good union jobs, maybe not glamorous, maybe horrible for your health, but good union jobs, if the companies can beat the UMWA and walk out on those jobs, heaven help the fast food workers.
That's right. Let me play my role as an economist and remind everyone watching or listening to this program that a pension is not something your company gives you.
Right.
It is not something that is a lovely benefit falling from the sky that someone else has to pay for. Pensions have always been things established usually over the objections of an employer, by the struggles of the workers who needed to have something they could rely on when they crossed age 65 or whenever they retired. And the way it worked was when the workers got it, the employer said, all right, now we'll put money in, but it's your money. It's money we're not going to give you in a wage increase. And in countless bargainings for contracts, the union would accept little or no wage increase by instead accepting as part of the gains they get from their extra productivity, from their extra hard work, they would get more of a contribution into their pension. So this is coming out of the workers' own pockets. So it to be taken away means that the company is taking away the benefit that the workers put the money into. And it's a kind of thievery.
The economic story is devastating and the human story is devastating because the human version of what you just described is generations of miners agreeing to do a job that keeps the lights on. It fueled our industrial revolution, runs factories from coast to coast, but which kills people. In exchange for that guaranteed health care. So that guarantee of health care...
Especially in your elderly years when all the bad health comes through.
If you make it to your elderly years with your black lung disease and all the rest, these agreements that the unions have won from the companies have fueled not just individual plans, health care plans, but clinics in communities that have been entirely abandoned by our health service. These are, as the miners will say, the Cadillac of health care plans. They're very proud of it. That's what they've gotten in exchange for all that life-threatening work and bringing disease home to their families. That should be turned back now. It's this mounting to kind of rolling up Appalachia and throwing it away.
Right. And it's also the massive assault on the standard of living through the unemployment, through the cutting of the job security, to the temporary worker explosion in America where basically workers have no benefits at all, on and on and on. This is just another part of that story. Tell us a little bit about another story that you've been interested in, a group of workers in Chicago that I've talked about on this program in the past also, who faced the shutting of their enterprise as a capitalist enterprise, but instead of accepting it, instead of resigning themselves, instead of walking away and looking in a bad job market for another thing, they took a different step. Tell us a little bit about who they are and what they did.
Well, it's kind of related in the sense that here is a group of workers in Chicago who have been part of a union, the United Electrical Workers, for many years. They've done what they were told to do, signed contracts with their bosses, and they've watched two sets of owners walk out on their factory, each for different reasons. The first, it looks like, was trying to reopen under non-union contracts and hire part-time workers just across town or move the equipment out of state. The second